Welcome to today's Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and we're going to start out the program with one of our new segments. It's called Going Native, and we're going to talk about the mountain hollyhock. Originally today, I had scheduled an interview with Tom Bettis, Utah County Horticulture Extension Agent, to talk about what to do when you see a great-looking bargain in the store. But I had a better conversation with him yesterday when I recorded it, so we're going to move that to a couple of weeks. But we're going to start out with Going Native, and then in studio today is Brent Black, USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and we're going to talk about fruit. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and in studio with me today is Jeanette Warner. She's owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. And this is the Going Native segment where we talk about native and drought-tolerant plants. And this week, it's the mountain hollyhock or the Ilamna rivularis.
Ilamna?
I always mess those up. I don't know my Latin very well.
Ilamna rivularis.
And what is this? This is one I'm not familiar with.
It's a cool plant. Not a lot of people know it. I have seen it in the nurseries quite a bit lately, but I also noticed that they were sitting there. Nobody was buying them because they don't know them. I've got some growing in my landscape, and when people see it blooming, they've got to have it. Midsummer, when it's hotter, is when it blooms.
That's great, because usually you think of natives as a flush of spring and early summer, and then it's gone.
That's right.
So this extends the flowering season.
And I keep mine clipped back. Well, for one thing, I collect the seed, but I keep mine clipped back, and it's just barely finished blooming. So a lot of these perennial wildflowers, you can do that. And with a little extra water, supplemental water will keep them flowering longer.
So this is a woody shrub?
No, it's herbaceous, so it dies back to the ground.
Okay.
Dies back to the ground, and it does look like a miniature hollyhock. The flowers are really small and bright pink, and because it's in the shade, it's really striking.
So it's another shade plant.
Dry shade.
I love it.
Dry shade.
that's two I get to put in my dry shade area.
Right.
How large does it get?
My philosophy is if you keep your plants close together, they control each other. And I learned that watching the Victory Garden. Jamie Drury, he said, if you plant these close together, then they're competing for the fertilizer, they're competing for the space, and it keeps them smaller. So you don't have to go out and prune them and always trimming them back. So in my yard, my mountain hollyhock is growing underneath my quaking aspen right next to the dogwood, and they all kind of keep each other in check. So mine get 2 feet, 2.5 feet tall by about 2 feet wide. That is how tall I let it get.
And how large are the blossoms? You said they were small.
About 1.5 inches, 2 inches across, which, very showy.
Yeah,
very showy.
And how long do the blossoms, they first appear for you?
In June, people start coming in and buying it in, towards the middle of June when they see it blooming. And then it will bloom until the end of July. But I do water it. And when I say I water it, maybe once every 10, 12 days.
Is this one, you say it dies back on its own?
In the fall, uh-huh.
And how hard is it to divide? It's like if it starts getting a little bit bigger than you want.
I've never divided it because I've never... I haven't had that problem.
It hasn't gotten big enough that you needed to
right.
do that. And what does it attract as far as pollinators?
Oh, the bees and the butterflies, definitely, yes.
And as far as the ground type needed for
it's that same average soil. It's that same average. I have clay soil. It's amended a little bit. But on that note, I have berms in my yard. I don't have flat ground except where my buffalo grass. Everywhere else is in raised beds. And so that makes it so it is a little bit better drained than just on the flat ground.
Okay. And it is zone hardy all the way down to zone 3.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that, other than the very tops of the mountains, that pretty well covers most areas where anyone would live.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's only good up to zone 5, though, so you wouldn't want to grow it in a desert area such as St. George, a little too warm?
I think it would be too warm. I'd never say don't do it. I'd say try it, and it works. And especially if it has extra watering, it definitely would need extra watering to look like a plant in St. George.
And you've got here, can be used in open settings in a perennial border, but timely maintenance is necessary to maintain size. So what kind of maintenance needs to be done?
That would be just keeping it trimmed back.
Oh, because it can get gangly?
With too much water, if they get too much water, they'll get gangly.
They'll say, woohoo, and then just take off.
That's right.
Okay. This sounds like a great flower to have, the mountain hollyhock. And that's the recommendation from Jeanette Warner of Wildland Nursery. She's the owner of Wildland Nursery, which is just south of Richfield in Joseph. That was a great plant to be able to have, and I highly suggest have it because I actually have one. I knew it by another name, maple leaf mallow, I think, but it grows really well in my garden. So that is the mountain hollyhock. Right now we're going to transition to fruits. We're going to talk with Brent Black and hope that you will join our conversation. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also go online and send an email, zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your questions or comments there. Brent, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, one of the things that we didn't get to talk about last week is fruit load. It just seems there's so much fruit on the trees this year. And I thought for sure apricots and peaches would have gotten, at least in Cache Valley, would have gotten done in by a fairly cold frost. It seemed to only help.
It really varied by the variety. Some varieties got hit pretty hard and didn't set a lot of fruit, and others set a bumper crop this year.
There's an apricot tree here on campus, an old one that's by what used to be the old parking office here in our parking lot, which is now the Kane College of the Arts, and it's a huge tree, just huge, and it was absolutely loaded.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a neighbor had two apricot trees, and one set a heavy, heavy crop, and one that bloomed slightly later didn't set any fruit because of a later frost, and the one tree was past its critical period. So it was a kind of an odd year. Some trees really had a heavy crop this year.
So I just happen to have the right varieties.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, let's talk about fruit load, because there have been a lot of trees that I've noticed that have people sticking 2x4s underneath them to try to hold them up. This is not good for the tree.
No, it really isn't. One of the challenges that will happen is trees that set a very, very heavy crop load, particularly, say, late peaches and some of the later ripening stone fruits and even later apples. When they set a heavy crop, a lot of the energy of that tree is going to go into ripening that fruit, to the detriment of stored reserves for next year. So a couple of things that you're going to probably see with some of these that crop very heavily, particularly in Cache Valley and northern Utah, is that they're going to go into the winter weak. If we have a harsh winter, you're going to see more damage on those trees that carried a heavy, heavy crop load. And when they break bud in the spring, they're going to be weaker. They may not set a heavy crop. Now, in the case of apples and pom fruits, you get the biennial bearing. So a lot of the varieties, once they've set a heavy crop, they're not going to bloom the next year. That's not so much the case with the stone fruits, but because they're weakened from carrying a heavy crop one year, they tend to not set fruit very well the next year.
So it just takes energy out of the tree, and mm-hmm. the tree then uses what reserves it has left to try to get back to a productive
right.
area.
So there's a lot of activity happens, a lot of growth happens before there's a lot of leaf area there. If you think of the stone fruits, they're blooming, the seeds are setting, the fruit starts to ripen mm-hmm. before there's much of a leaf area there. And if they don't have stored energy, then they're really inhibited in that process. And this is the time of year when they're trying to, some still ripening fruit, as well as developing energy reserves for the winter and the spring.
So that's why it will bypass that mm-hmm. that fruiting process and go into leaf production.
Right.
So when in the previous year does it decide, okay, I'm not going to worry about much fruit production next year.
So the flower buds form quite early. It's surprisingly early. With some crops like peaches, a lot of the flower bud initiation and early development took place in July. With apples, it's even earlier than that. It's maybe 4 or 5 weeks after bloom is when they start the process of creating flowers for the next year.
Just when you see little fruits.
Yeah, that's when they're setting up for next year. And so one of the challenges with the apples is you want to get in and thin quite early. And if you wait too long, you're going to get benefits in terms of crop load. You're not going to stress the tree so much for carbohydrates, and you're going to get better fruit size. But if you don't thin early enough, that the die is already cast, the buds that have started to form are going to be vegetative instead of floral.
So that's why, especially like with apples, you get the every other year mm-hmm. bearing, because you get a lot of apples 1 year, and so the tree then bypasses the setting up the fruit. And
right. So in apples, it just doesn't form flower buds. The presence of fruit there inhibits the formation of flower buds for next year, and that happens fairly early in the year. In the case of the stone fruits, it's not so much the development or initiation of flower buds. It's just a weaker tree. Those flowers tend to be less fruitful. They tend to set less fruit, and more of them just drop off the tree after bloom. So it's a different mechanism, but the same can be said. And again, one of the concerns I have with some of the crop load that we've seen, and one of the things that's interesting besides the heavy crop load, is we've had a relatively cool fall, and fruit development and ripening has been slower than normal. And if this continues and then we get very cold winter, the fruit's going to be there later than it normally would, and that the period after the fruit is removed is going to be shortened, so the tree won't have time to establish or to develop the reserves that it needs.
Wow. So a lot to remember. So it is the cooler weather good for fruit? I mean, as far as the taste and the ripening?
So what causes good quality fruit is to have cool conditions and bright sunny weather. So cool temperatures, but bright sunny weather. The hotter it is, the more the energy in that fruit is being respired, is being used up. As you cool that down, the respiration slows down, but you still want to have a lot of energy coming in. So our typical conditions where we have bright, sunny, warm days and cool nights are ideal for getting the sugar content high in our fruits. If we have warm nights, or if we have cool conditions that are overcast so that we're not getting a lot of sunlight, like we've had quite a bit of this fall, at least more so than normal for Utah, that will limit the development of that fruit.
So at least as far as Cache County, growing fruit can actually be pretty good if they can survive the winters, because you get the cooler nights.
Right,
and
right.
We have really
ideal conditions. Typically, we have ideal conditions for ripening fruit in northern Utah. The bright sunny days and cool nights. That's why our peaches and cherries are valued over a lot of other parts of the country that produce peaches and cherries. We do a better job just because of our conditions.
Really? I didn't realize that they were that sought after.
There's oftentimes in the marketplace, for the wholesale market, there's a premium paid for, say, peaches that are produced in the Intermountain West in Utah and Colorado, because we're growing at a higher elevation where we get these ideal ripening conditions in the summer. And so for the fresh market, they're sought after. We're a big tart cherry producing state. We're number two behind Michigan, and we had nearly a record crop this year in tart cherries. And our tart cherries are valued because the sugar content tends to be higher than those coming from Michigan or Wisconsin.
So our tart cherries aren't quite as tart as other areas.
Well, they're still tart,
yeah,
but they have more sugar in them. So, and that's what people that like them value, is that mix of the acid and the sugars. And when they're both high, you get a really premium quality fruit.
Let's talk about how, because this just question popped in my mind, how the fruit harvest has been this year.
So the numbers I've seen for tart cherries has been phenomenal. We've had a really, really strong year. The
No big hailstorms.
No big hailstorms. We had kind of really ideal conditions in the spring. Well, first of all, the trees came out of the winter strong with a lot of blossoms.
It wasn't a very cold winter.
Well, we had a cold snap in December that caused damage in some locations, but we didn't have a super heavy crop last year, so the trees weren't overstressed in general. So the reserves were good. Blossom set was good. There's a lot of blossom initiation, flower bud initiation was good. The blossom period was good. We had good pollination weather. Didn't have a lot of spring frosts to contend with. And so fruit set was just phenomenal. So the crop was very, very good for tart cherries. And we didn't have it didn't get as hot as it has been and stay hot so that the fruit could ripen, the trees could kind of keep up with that crop load. And so the fruit harvest was just phenomenal.
So that bodes well for next year because they weren't stressed this year
as much. So the thing that I'm hoping to see is that the trees remain healthy, that we get a long, mild fall so that the trees can recover completely. So tart cherry harvest was primarily in mid to late July, stretching a little bit into early August. And if we continue to have nice conditions through September, those trees should be able to recover and develop the reserves that they need for another good crop next year, we hope.
In Utah, where is most of the production done? I would think in the Willard area and then also mostly in Southern Utah County.
Right. So Southern Utah County is really the bigger of the producers, particularly for tart cherries anymore. Peaches, they're there as well as Willard, Perry area. There's still some peach production in the Dixie area for the early markets. But the predominant commercial tree fruit production is Southern Utah County.
How are peaches looking this year?
They've been good so far. The early ones are in and we're moving into the mid season ones. We've had pretty good production, good yields, and relatively good quality again.
And that's good news for the farmers.
It is. And for the consumers.
Yeah. Well, the farmers have just had, it just seems like a string of years where, you know, the fruit would set, it'd be there, and then a hailstorm would come in and get.
Yeah, and that's happened in a few isolated locations. It's always, Utah's not an easy place to grow fruit. We have more frequent hard winter freezes. We have a lot of spring frosts. We can get sunburn issues on some fruit because of the high intensity summer sunlight that we get. We see wind damage a lot of times in different locations. It's not an easy place to be in the fruit business, but the quality is fantastic when we can get through all of those pitfalls. And there's a consumer base here so that the local markets are good as well.
Which is why it's worth for me in Cache County, even though it's marginal for growing peaches, to replant about every 10 years when the tree gets hit with something or other that finally kills it, because the fruit is so good.
Yeah, it is. And peaches are traditionally a short life orchard tree anyway. So yeah, if you can get 10 years and get good production, maybe 50 or 60% of the time for a backyard situation, I'm perfectly happy with that. And I'm happy with, you know, I get some peaches off my peach trees. It's not commercial yield levels, and I don't have fruit on it every year, but it's often enough that it's worth the effort for me.
So curious, what do you grow? What varieties of peaches do you have in your yard?
Mine are just Suncrest. I don't have a lot of space. So I have,
so you look
peach
at the root stock as well, or
well,
do you
so
get standard and prune it back?
Yeah, I got standard. Peaches, typically we don't use a lot of dwarfing root stocks in peaches because we want to maintain vigor in peaches. We need to produce, since all the fruit is produced on one-year-old wood, then we've got to produce a lot of one-year-old wood. And so we're better off having a little bit more vigorous tree and then pruning to maintain enough productive wood than to have something. We've done trials with dwarfing root stocks, and in our climate, they runt out, or they just, you get some winter injury on a few branches, and they just don't have enough vigor to outgrow that, and so you really struggle. So we typically use fairly standard size peach, and really what we're interested in from a rootstock standpoint is finding those that are more tolerant to our alkaline soils.
Mm. And so, as far as other fruits, you have a small yard. So yeah, I can't imagine you not having only just peaches.
No. I have several blackberry plants. So I and mine are all triple crown. I like thornless. They're in production right now. I'm particularly enjoying those. They're like we were talking about last week. A triple crown produces large fruit. It's quite sweet if you let it hang long enough. And so we've really been enjoying our blackberry. And then I have a Himrod grape that I have. And it's so Himrod is oftentimes mistakenly referred to as cold hardy Thompson seedless, but it's not Thompson seedless. It's a green seedless grape that's an American or predominantly American bunch type grape. Whereas Thompson seedless is the European type. So they're very different.
And but Thompson seedless aren't exactly hardy to Cache Valley.
No, exactly. But I've had a lot of people tell me, I have a Thompson seedless. And when you go and look at it, it's not. It's one of the green-fruited American types. And Himrod's a good one. So I have that, and it takes up more space than I really have for it. But I enjoy the grapes.
You like it. Yeah. So how do you – are you trellising your blackberries? How do you keep them from taking over?
So I have both the grapes and the blackberries along a fence. And so I have I do a moderate job of tying up the blackberries so they don't get out and spread. I pinch them back to make sure that they don't – I don't get long, long canes that are flopping down and tip layering across my yard. So I'll pinch them when they get to be about 4 to 5 feet tall and then get some branching and maybe even pinch those if I get enough growth.
And how many plants do you have?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'd get better growth if I wanted to cut down the ash tree that I have shading a big chunk of my yard, but I really like the shade. So I put up with marginal yields and marginal growth to have the shade. So,
and what apples do you have?
I don't. My neighbor has a Red Delicious and a Gold Delicious, which is about 45% on my property. And sometimes he sprays them for coddling moth, and sometimes I do, but more often than not, I end up feeding them to my horses because they're so wormy.
What a treat for the horses.
Yeah, they like apples.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and respond or comment there. You can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com or call 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So let's go back to some of the ripening issues then. With peaches, and I'm going to forget if I don't ask this. Thinning them, you have to thin them to what?
So what I do, and this follows along with what commercial growers will do, is I'll select the number of what they call fruiting hangers or fruiting laterals that I'm going to keep. So I'm going to keep growth that grew. So when I go to prune this winter, I'm going to go out and select new shoots that grew this last year that are maybe 12 to 18 inches long and about the diameter of a pencil. And are fairly horizontal in growth. And a lot of the other new growth that grew this last year is going to get cut off. And
I'm going to leave. You have to prune stone prunes pretty heavily.
Yeah, you
got to
prune them pretty heavily. So I'm going to select how many of those fruiting laterals I want to keep. And then I'm going to allow 1 to 2 fruit per fruiting lateral. And so I might only have, on my tree, it's not very big. It got set back pretty hard by a hard winter in 2010. So I might keep 20 of those laterals on the whole tree. A bigger tree that's more mature, has more scaffold branches, I'd keep maybe more. But for my tree, I'm going to keep about 20 of those, and then I'll thin down to 1 to 2 fruits per fruiting lateral if that works out.
Do you thin cherries?
Thinning cherries is, you don't thin the flowers, you thin the fruiting wood. So you prune to reduce the amount of fruiting wood, and then that's what determines your crop load.
Because I can't imagine going there and picking out each little fruit. So
there's a couple of things. And commercially, one thing that can be done is you can actually treat the tree in the summer with a hormone that limits flower bud initiation. And that's actually used commercially. Not a lot in Utah, but in some climates where they have problems with oversetting and the trees will go into decline because they're cropping so heavily. We've actually started doing that at the research farm some, just because we've had 3 years in a row that we had record crops and the trees are really suffering. So this past summer, we treated some of the trees with this hormone. It's a gibberellin is the name of it, which reduces the number of flower buds so that we're hopefully won't have such a huge crop next year and the trees can recover a little bit.
And when does that get applied?
That's applied about a month after bloom.
Okay.
So, yeah, back in June was when we treated those.
So the fruit has set, but
The flower buds have initiated.
Yeah, but it just drops them off, almost kind of like a June drop, but earlier.
Well, no, what's happening there is it's the hormone is what inhibits flower bud initiation. So on those trees that are treated, we're going to have less flower buds that are forming. They don't start to form and then drop off. They just don't form.
They just don't form. Okay.
And the deal with cherries is that they have what's called a pure bud. So in apples, you have either a vegetative bud or what's called a mixed bud. It has flowers and it has leaves. In the case of cherries, you either get a flower bud or a vegetative bud. And by treating them with this hormone to cause this suppression of flower bud initiation, the net effect is that you get, not only do you get fewer flower buds, you get more vegetative buds, you get more leaves, which also helps the tree recover.
So with apples, how far apart should you go?
So it depends on the type that you're growing. If you have spur-type apples, you can have them a little bit closer together. And typically, the rule of thumb is about 4 to 5 inches apart along the branch. But that's with a strong spur-type. If you have less spur-type bearing, you got to space them out even further.
So how do you know if you have a spur-type?
Spur-type.
Just look for those spurs?
Yeah, the growth habits. So spur-types tend to not produce a lot of elongation growth. They don't have big, long shoots at the end of each branch. Hmm. And then the spurs, they form short fruiting side shoots called spurs. Usually they're about 3 to 4 inches long, and they just you don't get a lot of elongation growth. So those you can put the fruit a little bit closer. The rule of thumb I like to give is that you want to have with those spurs, you want to have less than half of them producing a fruit, and maybe one or at most two fruits per spur. And if the spurs are close together and you're thinning down so that only a third of them have fruit, those fruit might be closer than 6 inches apart, but you're still leaving at least half to two thirds of the spurs so that they're resting, so that they're not producing fruit and can produce flower buds for the next year.
Well, we've only got about 15 minutes left with Brent. If you'd like to get in your question or comments, it's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Or call 1-800-826-1495. We go to a question via email from Lynn, and she says, I have a very large, very old, red, delicious apple tree that is productive every year. Half the branches fruit 1 year, the other half the next. This year, one of the larger branches of the tree suddenly began to die after it had already started producing fruit. Now, the twigs are dry, the leaves are yellowish-brown, and there are small, unripened apples hanging all over the branch. What might have caused this, and what can we do to make sure it doesn't spread to the rest of the tree, which is currently growing many healthy-looking apples?
That could be a lot of different factors. So there's a couple of points from her email that I want to bring up. One is she's seeing the biennial bearing, what we were talking about before, where some of the branches are fruiting 1 year, some of the branches are fruiting another, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. The challenge that comes into play sometimes is if we get a frost that that limits fruit set 1 year, now all of those branches become synchronized. So they're all fruiting 1 year and then none of them are fruiting the next. So if you can, so balancing production, if you can get so that part of the tree has a crop and part of it doesn't, whether that's one branch does and one branch doesn't, or whether it's individual spurs within that branch, it works out the same. You just don't want everything synchronized. As far as what might have caused that branch to collapse, there's several different possibilities. One of which that always concerns me is we do have fire blight here, and fire blight will go into Red Delicious. And what'll happen is it's a bacterial disease that'll go in, and you'll see individual small shoots wilt and curl over. And so they look like they've been blasted with a flamethrower. That's why they call it fire blight. But what will sometimes happen is if you get an infection on a spur that's down on one of the scaffolds, that it'll wilt and die, but the bacteria continues to slowly spread through the vascular tissue of the plant. And it might only go a few inches a year in an older plant. But eventually what'll happen is that bacteria will spread down and all the way around the branch and girdle that branch. And I've seen that happen quite frequently where you've got a big old tree, you get a few fire blight strikes on spurs down near the base, and if they're left and not pruned out, they'll slowly spread and girdle that tree. So that, to me, sounds almost like that. Another possibility is that I don't know where she's emailing
Cache
from.
Valley.
Okay. So one of the things that we've seen this year is that December freeze that we got was a little bit harsher than a lot of people expected. And so weaker, older trees took some damage. And what happened was the damage was down in the trunk, in the vascular tissue. And so it was a similar thing to the fire blight. You kill a lot of the vascular tissue and the tree leaves out, the flowers open, they set fruit, and then they kind of wilt and die early on just because there's not enough vascular tissue that survived the winter to provide the nutrients and water that branch needed.
So should she prune out that branch?
Yeah, so that it's gone. So pruning it out, and the sooner the better. If it's fire blight, you can look for kind of the sunken, darkened bark down near the base.
And you can also see it in the tissue when you cut it.
Yeah, and you want to cut back past that so that doesn't continue to spread into the rest of the tree.
And then just use alcohol after every cut you've made?
Or Clorox to, you know, dip your pruning tools in Clorox solution will actually surface sterilize them in between cuts so you're not spreading the bacteria around. Fire blight's a nasty one because if you cut through an actively growing lesion and get the bacteria on your pruning shears or on your saw or whatever, and then you go over and start pruning something else, you'll just spread the bacteria all over it. It has a wide host range.
Mm. Well, Lynn, thanks for your question. And I've noticed on my gala that, and it hasn't actually happened the last couple of years, but I've had this gala for 12 years, and it'll get a little bit of fire blight here, a little bit there, but it never really gets into the tree. It just seems to be on the tips in a couple of spots, and that's it.
So what determines how fast it moves through is the scion variety, which in your case, Gala, the rootstock will affect it. So one of the hot items right now is there's a series of new apple rootstocks coming out that are fire blight resistant, the Geneva series. I think we've talked about these on the program before. So if you have a very, very susceptible rootstock or a very susceptible scion, it determines how fast the bacteria moves through. That doesn't mean you're not going to get an infection. It just means how fast it will run through the tree. But either way, when you see those little strikes, the best thing to do is to prune back and get them out of the tree before they've had a chance to spread. And like I mentioned before, one of the really scary things that can happen is if you get a fire blight strike on a spur that's down on a main scaffold, because it doesn't have to go very far before it'll kill that scaffold. We had, I believe it was back in 2007, we had a really bad fire blight year, and it got into some older trees and moved down. And within a year or two, we lost some big, big trees just because we got infections in spurs that were near the base of scaffolds.
I had a vigorous growing cameo apple. Loved the apple, but it wasn't older than about 6 or 7 years, and it was gone. Within a month, the whole tree was gone.
So you bring up another really good point there. Besides the scion and the rootstock cultivar, The other factor that affects how fast fire blight moves is how vigorous the tree is growing. So if you've got a slower growing older tree or a tree that's on a dwarfing rootstock that tends to grow slower and a little bit weaker, the fire blight's not going to move as quickly as it does through the really succulent, fast growing tissue. And so we see that a lot of times, like in the year that we had back in 2007, I believe it was, we saw a lot more injury and damage in young trees that were very vigorous than in trees that had been in the ground for 8 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, where you just saw these little strikes all over the different spurs and not running down through the tree.
And is there a rootstock that's EMLA 26?
Is super susceptible.
And that was the one that the cameo was on.
It's like, I don't know, it's somehow a fire blight attractant in my experience. It's a semi or a fairly strong dwarfing rootstock, a little bit bigger than M9. And it has a lot of advantages, but fire blight is not one of them. And we saw whole orchards that were on M26 go out that year just because of the susceptibility.
Do you know, and I've got, I've never seen any fire blight in my hardy Asian pear, but I've got a Starking Delicious pear and I've got Bartlett. I've never had, other than just a teeny little bit in those before. And yet my parents have got a Bartlett and they couldn't keep the Bartlett. They'd put in a new one and then it'd be
pears,
right back.
Pears are notoriously susceptible in general. Bartlett, Bosque, Anjo, the typical ones that we would want to grow. The ones we like to eat are the ones that tend to be fairly susceptible. And why yours has kind of avoided that is a little bit surprising. But
I'm hoping it's because there really aren't any other pears around me. And it's at the back of my property and there's a pasture behind me. So
isolated enough.
Yeah,
hopefully.
A little bit more isolated. I want to make sure we talk about knowing when to pick. Mm-hmm. So can you leave... I mean, it's obvious you can leave the fruit on the tree too long, but when you're looking at a pear for a pear, how do you know when you've got to pick it? Because with Bartlett-type pears, you've got to pick them before they've actually started to turn yellow.
So, right, the European pears need to be picked and then what they call after-ripened or conditioned so that they ripen properly. So it's a little trickier. With most of the other fruit we grow, you can usually let them hang until they're fully ripe.
Like an apple, I'm going to go out and pick it, eat it. Well, that's not quite ripe.
Yeah,
so leave
if it's starchy, I leave it there. So with pears, there's a number of things that you can look at. One thing that commercial growers will do is they'll harvest them and do a few fruit and then do a pressure test to see how firm they are, because they'll start to soften a little bit before they're
Just by squeezing it with their hand?
Yeah, you can't tell by squeezing with your hand because the difference is too subtle. They use a special tool that can measure pressure. For a home gardener, a couple things to look at. One is to look at the color on the shaded side or the protected side of the fruit. So with say Bartlett, the greenness will start to go away. The chlorophyll will break down in the skin. And when that greenness is going, that's one indicator. Another is the fruit separating from the branch. So how easy does it come off? If you lift and twist, does the fruit separate easily or do you have to really pull it off? That abscission layer that allows it to separate is a good indicator.
Sometimes though, I've noticed with my Starking Delicious, I'll lift up and it comes right off.
And it's still not quite there.
Still not quite there. Yeah. I'll cut into it because I'll look at seeds.
Yeah, that was
and
the
seeds will be turning brown, but they're still got like white on one side or something. So
that was the third one I was going to bring up is seed color. Cutting them open and looking. If the seeds are pearly white, then or even partially white, like you talked about, then they need a little bit longer. Once the seed turns brown or black, depending on the variety, that's a pretty good indication that they're ready to go.
All right, so let's look at peaches. I've been told that I don't want to leave the peach on completely because I remember one year that it just was fibrous. It just didn't. It wasn't a good peach.
Yeah. So and they'll the challenge with peaches and apricots and so forth is they'll tend to ripen in the middle of the fruit more than they do on the outside sometimes. So really, what you look for there is looking at the ground color, which is the non-sun exposed color. So in my backyard, I have a sun crest, and right now it's got a nice red blush on the sunny side of the fruit. The backside is still just a little bit green, And so I'm waiting just a little bit longer until that turns to a more of a yellow. And then I like to test just to see if there's a little bit of give under the peel.
And that's when you can squeeze.
Yeah, you don't want to crush it, but just a light squeeze on a few fruit to see. And once there's a little bit of give and that green has gone away, then pick them and store them at cool temperatures and let them continue to ripen off the tree for a little bit of time until they get that soft melting flesh that we like to eat.
So if I leave them on the tree until they look absolutely perfect, they're probably beyond where they are.
It depends somewhat on the variety, but yeah, they'll start to get dry and pulpy and fibrous on the inside, particularly down near the pit.
Okay. And with apples, that's pretty easy. You just pick it, eat it.
It's with apples, a lot of it, I mean, if you're doing it commercially, you can look at seed color, you can look at firmness, you can look at peel color and so forth. But really, it's starch to sugar. Apples, as they're developing, accumulate starch. And then as they ripen, that starch is broken down and converted to sugar. And you can taste starch. If you don't know what it tastes like, go bite into a raw potato and that's starch. And if you get that starchy taste to the apple, let it go a little longer.
And I've noticed that you can also look at the flesh, and it looks it has a little tinge of green coloring to it, maybe. And like when I picked my galas 2 days ago, just a couple of them, it just looked a little bit green, had just a little bit of starch. I mean, they're perfectly edible, and I've still been bringing them to work to eat, but I'm going to leave the whole tree going for a little bit more.
Until that, and look at that ground color, make sure that chlorophyll's gone or nearly gone on the shaded side, so that gala is an example of a bicolor fruit. So the shaded side of the fruit needs to be getting yellow, or beyond yellow when it's ready.
Okay. Well, we've pretty well reached the end of our time. Brent, thanks for coming back in again.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, and he's been my guest for the last couple of weeks. Next week is going to be the first of the month, and so it will be Dan Drost, and I hope that you'll send us your vegetable and gardening questions then. So thanks for listening to The Zesty Garden. Up next is Petals and Prose with Nancy Williams.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams. I'm going to read to you today from an essay by Kathleen Dean Moore in her book, River Walking, Reflections on Moving Water. This one's called The Salish River. At the swimming holes, frayed swing ropes point down into deep pools where salmon hold, heavy with eggs, waiting for the time. Overhead, clouds sag with the weight of the water they hold, waiting, holding it in. While close under the clouds, blackbirds gather in drifting flocks, silently tipping and falling in formation. Each leaf of the vine maple tree holds on to its branch by the strength of a single layer of cells, and from each fiery leaf, from each bare twig, hangs a single drop of water. On the bank, at the turn of the river, the weight of the last blackberries bends the canes. Fishermen in their boats look for long minutes at the sky, and then slowly, deliberately, pull on their slickers and stow their gear under the deck. Even the river is still, pooled up, black and shiny behind the shallows. The narrow strip of beach between the fern wall and the water is cobbled with stones the size of apples, still damp from when the river was high. Flood water has undercut the bank here so that the thick roots of a big leaf maple hang down over the beach and weave a chair that I can sit on, like the cane chair that used to be next to my father's bed. A mile of hemlock is at my back, a forest, and a high bank on the far side of the river closes off the rest of the world. Now that Frank has rowed away downstream, the only people I see are fishermen, and they pass quickly without speaking, maybe without seeing me. I have come to the river looking not so much for solace as for corroboration, for evidence that I've made the best decision, the safest bets. I'm not sure what the evidence will be, although I have a feeling it won't be conclusive. Answers come from rivers only reluctantly. You have to build understanding out of small moments. You have to cut the pieces out of a day and fit them together in a new way, like puzzle pieces or promises. Not long ago, I was in another state, another time, and my sisters and I were bargaining with Reverend Hartman about the scripture for my father's funeral. My father had picked out an Old Testament verse, Ecclesiastes 3. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Reverend Hartman said, fine, but what about the New Testament? What do you mean, what about the New Testament? I said. What about the resurrection, the life? Whosoever believeth in me shall not perish. I glanced at my sisters for permission. We thought we might leave that part out. We still laugh when we think about how annoyed Reverend Hartman was and how hard he tried not to show it, but he should have seen this coming. If ever you're going to want the truth to be told, it's at your own funeral. And Reverend Hartman knew my father had no expectations about eternal life. He was a biologist, and biologists are more interested in plant succession than in plant longevity. That's why Ecclesiastes was perfect, rejoicing in change, acknowledging the power of the evidence that nothing lives forever, honoring the importance of that fact. I'm willing to be surprised, my father had told Reverend Hartman, and we thought he should have been grateful to get even that much from somebody who studied bacteria. In the end, we staved off the born anew, living hope resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, kept Ecclesiastes 3, and added a verse from Psalms, "This is the day that the Lord hath made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it." To be honest, I don't think my father felt any need for life after death. He was an academic, and so he was an observer, fascinated by every fact, and I imagine he expected dying to be interesting enough. And besides, dying would mark the end of a long struggle with illness, so it might well be a happy time, bringing the same quiet pleasure that came from turning in his grade sheets at the end of a semester. It would be a time of fulfillment, of ripeness, a time to be cherished. And if there was yet more to come, well, he could think about that when the time came. In my father's house, surrounded by the color-coded files, the glass jars of pond water on the window sills, little fairy shrimp swimming in the sunlight, covers of scientific magazines framed on the wall, close-up photographs he had taken, a single cicada on a blade of grass, a dandelion seed head, full-blown. There in my father's house, it was easy to be sure that life today matters more than life everlasting. Everything in the house gloried in the moment. The fact of things, everything focused on how things are, how wonderful, all the joy-filled facts. But when we emptied the house and sent books off to the libraries and collections off to museums, boxed up the piled photographs until nothing was left but clean squares on the carpet where furniture used to stand, it got harder. "Let us rejoice and be glad in it" was refuted. No, worse than that, it was absorbed by the empty spaces in the house, and I came away not knowing what to think. So I have come to sit by the river because I don't know what else to do after having sat for so many days beside my father's bed. I reach for my parka because the air is getting darker, the wind cooler, the season inching toward the breaking point when the leaves, the clouds, and the salmon can't hold on any longer. I can see the time coming, see it far downstream, see it twist the leaves upside down and send them sailing off their branches. I can see it transform the grass from gold to silver down along the gravel beds. The wind hits first. On the beaten water, waves of pallor wash upriver ahead of the weather. Great clouds of yellow leaves fill the air and spin upstream. Suddenly a salmon breaks. A big, black, red-bellied salmon charging up out of the depths, rupturing the stillness of the river, driving toward the shallows, splashing with its tail fin, raising hills of water that slide over its back. I put on my wool hat and pull up my hood. The river is white with movement, scaled with fallen leaves, the riffles sliced by the dorsal fins of the driven salmon, making desperate charges to get over the boulders and floating backward over the gravel wherever the water breaks. The salmon are moving toward the spawning beds by Buck Creek. Year after year, fish runs mark the times of a river. In the summer, little glancing fish crowd the water. The parr and the resident cutthroat, fish of light. The first September rains bring the sea-run cutthroat into upriver pools, where they feed under willows vague and gray in coastal mist. But the days dry out under yellow skies and the river drops so low that in the riffles, fishermen wearing hip boots climb out of their boots and drag them banging over rocks downstream into the next deep pool, blocked by the same shallows the salmon wait in salt water at the mouth of the river or in the deepest tidewater pools. Heavy driving rains return in late October, raising the river to near flood, and the salmon push hard upriver. When the first raindrops hit the water, I move in under the boughs of a hemlock. A drop bounces up where each drop of rain falls. As more rain hits, more beads of water pop up in the air. All across the pool, drops of water ping up, ping up, ping up, raising concentric circles that do-si-do through other circles and duck onto flat water. The rain drives down harder and the circling sets give way to hills and valleys, crests and troughs, until the whole river is noisy with movement, chaotic and crowded. A fisherman drifting alone in his boat leans over the river, throwing heavy fly line through the air, not noticing the still water that gathers in the folds of his jacket and runs over the shadows under the floorboards of the boat. In late afternoon, the rain dissipates into a mist that sizzles on the surface of the river, raising vague streamers of steam into the hemlock trees that line the shore. Low light washes in under the clouds and touches each ripple on the river, illuminating each drop of water suspended from every leaf and twig and cone. When damp wind slides into the valley, the forest comes alive. Hemlock boughs shake off their loads, tossing up beads of light that fall where rain had fallen before. There is a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. I examine the words in my mind, their sequence, their sweep, the sounds they make when I speak them aloud. Weep, laugh, mourn, dance. I carefully fold my parka into my pack, tuck my pant legs into my boots, and start the long walk up the river. Thanks for being with me. I'm Nancy Williams. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.